Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding provided by the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and by Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
Religion and the Power of Narrative, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with scholars from the University of Vienna, the State University of Leiden, and Indiana University. The interplay of history, myth, and religion is central to the narratives that shape our lives. Whether as old as a sacred text or as new as the sermon you heard last Sunday, these narratives become powerful devices that can give meaning both to individual lives and to abstractions like progress or destiny. First on Soundings this week, Monika Fluternick of the University of Vienna and Jan Fokelman of the State University of Leiden discuss history, myth, and religion. Later on the program, you'll hear from Gerald Strauss of Indiana University. I'll talk with him about religion, history, and the German Reformation. During her recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Monika Fluternick worked on a study of narrative and language. Jan Fokelman came to the center to work on a study of the Old Testament book of Samuel. Monika Fluternick.
Narrative is kind of the medium for both myth and history. And in history, it's more self-reflexive because the historian thinks more closely and more deliberately about the way in which he or she is using the narrative.
The historian does something to history, rearranges it in the writing.
Right, and is usually very aware of the sources and who has said what and how to combine this. I mean, if you look at the earliest Greek narratives, like Thucydides, for instance, I mean, he goes on and on about where he got this from and how he combined this and so on and so forth. And Herodotus has these various sources telling different versions of the same event. And then he juxtaposes them. He says, well, on the one hand, he said that. And on the other hand, this source says the other thing. So it's very deliberate and very reflexive. Whereas in myth, you're supposedly confronted with this narrative. And there is this belief that it is truer because, you know, it's been handed on through the centuries.
Because it's older.
And, you know, there's no reflexivity about it.
Right.
I think that is true partly of the Bible, that and that is part of the way it's also being used, that it is more original because, you know, there is not this additional layer of interpretation.
A question for Jan Fokelman. Human nature doesn't change. Is somebody going to look back at the way we live and find these structures of myth and history? What about that in the telling of our own times?
Yes, I think so. Even nowadays, when we are producing official and clean historiography, we are obsessed by our own ideologies and blind spots, etc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the old days, I think ideology was to be taken for granted. It was just in the narrative, and the authors were not ashamed to bring forward what they thought was good and bad, and what their belief was. Nowadays, a modern historiographer has to be very cautious with this because he knows his readers are very critical and try to catch him on ideology, you know. But we have our preferences and prejudices and our desires too. I think most of the belief that we suppose is advocated by the Bible is just presupposed by it instead of sold to heathen people. It's often not on a missionary course, I think. It just presupposes. It's a story by an Israelite narrator told to an Israelite audience, and they have a lot of things in common that don't need to be spelled out anymore, you know. On the other hand, most of the readers of the Bible in our civilization have been told by their parents and their schools that this is the Holy Writ, and that directs and manipulates their view and makes them more sensitive, but on the other hand, gives them a lot of prejudices when they look to the Bible.
I think that because the story material can be so very different, I think you do have different kinds of stories, but they all are a confrontation with some issue, and there is all a kind of experience that is at the center of them, which is really important. And I think that what the analysis of narrative has told us has been less in the sense that, you know, structuralism analyzed, say, the folk tales and sort of said, well, there are just so many combinations of issues. I think what is emerging from the more recent work on discourse analysis that is analyzing oral storytelling is actually that there is one basic structural unit, and that you start maximizing by adding one unit to the other, and then slowly you start treating the larger structural units and juxtaposing these.
We think, for example, Jan Fokelman is writing about the Book of Samuel. Whoever wrote that, I mean, whatever group of people wrote that. We think about people like Homer, or we think about Dante and Spencer and Milton. Is that gone, vanished altogether? We still live with narrative. Mm-hmm. How does it happen in the modern world?
It's very strange. I was just thinking about that when Jan talked. I think that one of the problems is that our conception of what's classic or what's sort of really mythic is so much linked to the way of existence of the people. And this whole story world that comes through the Iliad and the Bible, or even the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. I mean, we tend to think in terms of heroes and castles and power and so on and so forth. And real democracy really has changed so much of this world, and the living standard has gone up, and so there's such a spread of... It's just a different world. And so it's very difficult to compare in the makeup of the world. But I think actually that something like, no, some people may be shocked by this, but I think something like Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow would be a suitable document on the same lines about the 20th century, maybe in 200 years'
time. In other words, a cultural anthropologist or archaeologist looking back will find in that book the kinds of things that we find in these so-called biggies back on our cultural horizons.
Yes, I think so. I think there is a certain density which is a requirement for this kind of major opus that will give later generations this kind of feeling that it really reflects what was going on in that age and has sort of been raised to a mythic level. And I think it needs to reflect some of the chaos in that world too. And that's, I think, where the pinch brings the two things really together.
Right.
And without actually, and that's, I think, is interesting and different from these other works, really reflecting a certain kind of ideology,
mm-hmm.
Very deliberately at least.
Well, let's pick up on that, Monica Fluternick and Jan Fokelman. Jan has mentioned ideology. You just mentioned it here, Monica. The argument goes these days that all literature, regardless of whether it's the great literature, the Bible, the great code, in the words of one of our literary critics, or the trivial and the popular, that all of it is local and political, that it's impossible for it to speak across the ages, for a kind of literature to transcend time. Jan, you've spent most of your life looking at a book that appears to transcend the ages in some way or another. Are you going to attack or defend that?
To attack that, certainly.
In what way?
Because the simple fact that we are paying so much attention to this ancient legacy in itself is already a sign that there's much more in it than just local political elements.
Uh-huh. Does that mean that you believe in a large word like truth?
Well, personally, I'm a secular reader,
uh-huh.
but I see that penetrating way in which the human condition is told to us in these stories is so profound that I feel excited by it, and that I have to ask the question to myself over and over again, what is in it that is so compelling and charming, fascinating, and sometimes appalling. Mm-hmm. So I'm on a parallel track with the normal believer, in the sense that I feel that this is a profound text that still has hidden a lot of hidden meanings and secrets even.
But the appeal cannot be simply aesthetic. It cannot be simply rhetorical.
No, it's experiential, I would say, in the sense that these narratives have a deep knowledge of our human predicament, mm-hmm. our uncertainties, the chaotic state of our world, and they show marvelously how human beings are ignorant and have to struggle all the time to find a little grain of truth.
Monica Fluternik?
Well, it's I have come to think more and more, looking at narratives, and particularly looking at old texts, how it's really through the particular that the narrative experience works. And I think we can see this very easily in the everyday sense we get, that if somebody is just talking on a very general level without examples, as we are doing now, it's harder to understand than if you're actually picking an example and looking at this example. And I think that particularly with the social conditions that existed until very recently, with a lot of people not having very much education, it was absolutely crucial for any kind of teaching or any kind of understanding to be conducted through narrative, which is where you get all these exemplar in medieval stories, mm-hmm. and within the sermons and everything, because that is the kind of thing where through empathy with the story or with one of the people in the story, you would really start thinking about the situation, start thinking about this story on a higher level, that is through experiencing it and then getting out of it again and looking at it reflexively, mm-hmm. rather than trying to generate all these truths out of the story and then looking at them sort of in an abstract framework, which would be the scientific way of doing it. And I think really that narratives are the sort of the counterpart to the scientific way of doing things. And I think that the basic rift in the Western world has really come at the point when the human sciences abdicated from looking at narrative and started being inspired by the scientific model.
Monica Fluternik teaches at the University of Vienna, Jan Fokelman at the State University of Leiden. Both recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where Monica Fluternik worked on a study of language and narrative, and Jan Fokelman on a study of the Old Testament Book of Samuel. This is Soundings, Conversations and Commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on History and Religion continues. You'll hear next from a recent visitor to the center. Gerald Strauss is a professor at Indiana University who specializes in the history of the German Reformation. Among the questions posed by scholars who study Martin Luther and his times are, why did the Reformation occur and what did it accomplish? Gerald Strauss treats issues like that in his book, Luther's House of Learning, Indoctrination of the Young in the German Reformation. Gerald Strauss.
Well, let me explain first that the title, which may be somewhat ambiguous sounding, refers to a passage in the book of Ecclesiasticus, or Jesus Sirach, which was one of the, it's an apocryphal book, but one which was much used, particularly in the pedagogical literature of the Reformation, and it refers to the fact that the Lutheran Reformation attempted many things, but one of the things the Lutheran Reformation attempted was to bring some kind of religious and also civic education to the masses of people through the schools and through the processes of catechization.
All right, now you could be talking about America in the 1990s. How do we make civic-minded, productive citizens, not necessarily with a lot of religious ideology or religiosity or baggage attached to it, but the challenge remains the same, does it not?
The challenge is always the challenge felt and faced by a society attempting to perpetuate its values. That is the theme of my book. I'll come back to that in a moment, but if you will allow me, I want to explain something else. Many of the great interpreters of the Reformation have always made the point that Luther himself did not believe in a Reformation in this sense.
Started it and he didn't believe in it?
Well, what he started is not, of course, what became, but that is right. A common experience that historians constantly point out. Unexpected results are usually the outcomes of historical events. Uh-huh. No, what Luther did was to act on his conscience and on his understanding. He did not only feel strongly, he knew that a reformation is not something that human beings can accomplish. A reformation is something that only God can make, and we wait for the outcome of the divine dispositions of all this. What we do on earth is to make the life that we lead a little more tolerable in various ways, largely by acting as Christians toward our neighbors. But I've got to finish this point, Wayne. When one goes beyond Luther's writings and Luther's actions to the actions of his fellow reformers and especially of those who come after him, the objective of the Reformation changes first in a subtle and then in a quite decided way. And it becomes, and historians I think are really clear about that, it becomes an attempt to change the patterns of life. And it should be said in this connection that the concept of sin, not just original sin, but the concept of sin is usually, or has, let me say, has often been used in order to preempt any efforts to fundamentally change human society, to make improvements. The argument always being, well, it's no use attempting anything because mm-hmm. original sin or the sinful condition of humankind will always defeat any effort.
Well, nonetheless, let's put it this way. If the Reformation failed, at least on the level of reshaping character, that is to say, projecting into the future the sort mm-hmm. of society that these men and women wanted to have, is it reasonable to ask you why? I mean, do we have to go back to original sin, or can we talk in terms of politics and culture and expressive mm-hmm. behavior that really don't have that much to do with theological kinds of things?
Well, let me say first, in case someone who is listening has the theological knowledge to look into some of the subtexts that are going on here, to say that the Reformation failed is to answer a particular kind of question. If you assume, as I do in my book, that it was an important objective of the Reformation and a self-consciously pursued objective of the Reformation to improve not only human life, the human condition, but also the human character, with a conviction that this could be done. If you say this, then the Reformation has to be declared a failure, because this was simply not accomplished. Many interpreters of the Reformation would not agree with my framing of the question, mm-hmm. namely that it was indeed an important objective of the reformers to accomplish this. They say the Reformation was about something else. The Reformation was about the restoration of the gospel right. to its proper place. The Reformation was about the curtailment of the excesses of the Roman Catholic Church. All these things are true. But one way of looking at the Reformation is the way in which I do in my book, namely the attempt to change the character and the values of life through education.
Gerald Strauss, talk to me for a few minutes about Martin Luther. Again, you are a scholar of the German Reformation. You mm-hmm. have a book here, Luther's House of Learning. We've been talking about the ways historians do the Reformation, the mm-hmm. way they interpret it. Let's look at this one figure for a moment. Again, we've got enough material here to cover hours and hours of conversation. How has Luther's life been looked at? How is it being looked at today?
I'm hesitating because there are so many biographies and there are so many biographers of Luther that I'm finding it difficult to generalize. Luther's life was, of course, looked at in his own time, not only in words. Among his first biographers were his closest right-hand man, Philip Melanchthon, and various other of his associates who wrote studies of him and a set of funeral sermons which retraced the life of Luther. Luther, of course, was presented pretty much as not only a hero, but as a saint, mm-hmm. a man sent by God to reestablish the gospel in its rightful place and to cleanse the Christian religion of all the abuses that the Catholic Church was accused of.
That's a big
by Protestants. that biographical tradition, if you can call it that, is really a form of hagiography, lasted for a good long while. But in the course of the 19th century, it was replaced, generally speaking, by a critical tradition. Many biographers and historians looked at the life of Luther from the point of view of someone who was trying to understand a man in his particular historical setting. And I would say that that has remained the tradition pretty much to the present time, although Luther is such a powerful figure that everyone who studies him, if only casually, falls under his spell in a way. And can I say one more thing about that?
Absolutely.
One way in which Luther determines to a certain extent what the biographer is able to find, no matter how critical, how independent, maybe how non-believing outside the Lutheran religious tradition a biographer may be, Luther determines the course that a biography will take by the sheer mass of his writings. The man was an absolutely indefatigable writer. His works published in the authoritative critical so-called Weimar edition occupy an enormous shelf of big fat volumes.
That's a good way to fool the biographers.
Well, not so much to fool, but to overwhelm the biographer.
Right. Well, let me ask you to be specific. We've got just a few minutes remaining here, Gerald Strauss. Give me a sense amidst the diversity, the mm-hmm. massiveness of that background. Give me a sense of one or two anecdotes or examples of the kind of thing that the challenges that a biographer of Luther is faced with when he or she comes to interpret the evidence and mm-hmm. to speak as truthfully and accurately as possible to a modern audience about this man.
Well, I could select a number of them, but let me select one in particular. Luther himself, as many great individuals who knew in at least the latter part of their lives that they were going to be the subject of historical investigation for centuries to come, Luther constantly reinterpreted his own life and his own experience, and the great achievements, or at any rate the great undertakings that he had attempted.
It sounds like Walt Whitman in the United States, somebody who's a sort of his own spin doctor and PR man all the way through his life.
Well,
or is that to trivialize
you,
Martin
you would certainly get me into trouble with my colleagues if I used the term spin doctor. Uh-huh. And I would say the one thing that every biographer of Luther, no matter how unfriendly, is bound to conclude is that this man had a towering honesty and sincerity, uh-huh. Which I suppose the term spin doctor would vitiate if
that's
you
not appropriate.
Used it. But Luther was, first of all, he was constantly in a position to talk about himself. He was surrounded by friends and associates. He never took a meal by himself. He was always at a table with his friends, and they had nothing better to do as soon as the meal was over but to go to their rooms and write down what is being said, what had been said. Mm-hmm. And the so-called table conversation was later on edited and published. And in his table talk in particular, Luther goes over his experiences, sometimes recalling events 20, 30, 40 years earlier in his life, and interprets them, and in doing so, of course, reinterprets them, and thus, in a way, determines, as I said a moment ago, his own biography. So the biographer is constantly faced with the autobiographer. Luther did, of course, not write an autobiography, but there is autobiography in almost everything that he committed to paper or spoke to friends who then wrote it down.
So in other words, we don't need to be suspicious of him, but we need to be very cautious. We need to be prepared for the other side of the coin, that is to say, the negative interpretation lurking there.
Well, historians are always cautious. Usually historians face the problem of having not enough evidence on which to base their conclusions. In the case of Luther's biography, the problem is the opposite. There is so much, and a good deal of it is of an inevitably contradictory nature, that it is simply overwhelming.
Gerald Strauss is a professor at Indiana University. His books include Luther's House of Learning and Law, Resistance, and the State, published by Princeton University Press. This is Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on History and Religion is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 586. That's program number 586. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, listen for a discussion about a new history of popular entertainment in America. Wayne Pond will talk with Robert Allen about his book, Horrible Prettiness, Burlesque and American Culture. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join us again next week at this time on this radio station. Partial funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
History and Religion, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for scholars from the University of Vienna, the State University of Leiden, and Indiana University. Monica Fluternick and Jan Fokelman will discuss biblical narrative in the age-old stories that shape our lives. Gerald Strauss will talk about the meaning of the German Reformation and the life of Martin Luther. Religion, Myth, and History. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.